This podcast is brought to you by BrunnerAcademy.com, your online resource for the best public speaking, presentation, storytelling skills courses. Become a rock star communicator in any setting. Visit BrunnerAcademy.com.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to Live Your Best Life with Liz Brunner. I'm Liz, and my goal with each episode is to share stories of people who are recreating their lives or rising above challenges to write their next chapters with authenticity. These stories give me the courage to go after living my best life, and I think they will do that for you too. If you like this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review wherever you listen to the show, so this podcast can continue to inspire next chapters all over the world. In her early 20s, my guest was a PR hotshot, climbing the ladder of success and living the glamorous high life in New York City. To the outside world, it looked like she had it all together. But on the inside, fearing she could never live up to her perfect trailblazing television mom, Joan London, she held a secret. She was a high-functioning cocaine addict. Barely able to keep her head above water, her house of cards finally fell, and she nearly lost everything. Today, she has transformed her life, and she is helping others do the same. Jamie Hess, welcome to my podcast.
Liz, thank you so much for having me.
Delighted to have you here. You are known today as a wellness entrepreneur, media personality, one-on-one coach, and now the host and executive producer of the Gratitudeology podcast. You say gratitudeology is now your way of life. What do you mean?
Well, it's a great question, and it really does go all the way back to the beginning, Liz. And thank you for that great intro. You know, this is really, it's funny. That's usually my little mic drop moment, you know, because people have me on and they think I'm just going to talk about like being an influencer or an entrepreneur. And I'm like, here's the fun early part. I was a sick and suffering drug addict and it nearly killed me. And they're like, what? But now it's kind of out there. And I do believe in leading with making your mess your message. Mm-hmm. And that's really why I've taken this on as my journey. So when I had that dark and twisty part of my life, which by the way, was my entire teens and 20s, and it was really dark and twisty. I was not like, oh, let's have a little fun on the weekends. It took me down, Liz. Yeah. I was really, like you said, high functioning addicts, I actually think can have it worse because nobody knows.
Right. It's a secret.
No one knows. And so all of that said, when I did get sober, so it took me a couple passes at it. I was like a chronic relapser for a couple of years, but I just like anything, you got to keep practicing until you get good at it. When I got sober, two things happened. Number one, I basically like discovered wellness, which I think happens to a lot of people when they get sober because they're like, well, damn, I have a lot of time on my hands. Maybe I'll get abs. You know what I mean? Like, oh my God. And what was so funny was that when I dropped into places like Barry's Boot Camp or Soul Cycle, I found that tribal energy and community that I've been looking for on the dance floor for 15 years. So that was number one. I was like, oh shoot, it's been here the whole time. Who knew? And I started this Instagram account called NYC Fit Fam, where I started sharing my tips and tricks for leading a healthy, fit, sober, happy life. So I started becoming a thought leader. And that really helped me because I believe we can only keep what we have by giving it away. Now, the second thing that happened is I really fundamentally started to understand gratitude. And that's what you have to get when you first go into 12-step recovery. They say you have to get prayer, meditation, gratitude, all of these things that were so foreign to me because I was just surviving.
Right.
And when you've almost died, waking up every day is just like, I'm just happy to be here. It is a gift every single day I wake up. And 20 years later, I still feel that. And I'm telling you, that is all I want to pass forward. I believe that an attitude of gratitude is the heartbeat of happiness. I also believe that gratitude is the antidote for anxiety and burnout. And so that's the message. That is my absolute mission in life today, is just to pay that forward.
How wonderful that you have discovered that now. Now, you've had to go through a heck of a lot to get there. We're going to unpack some of that because when you were in college at NYU, you got an internship with a major PR firm, eventually landing a job there, and you were representing these major brands. You were working with McDonald's and W Hotels, and you were leading all these celebrity campaigns. But as you've mentioned, by your own admission, you were living this double life, and you had a lot of self-destructive behaviors and vices. I mean, you've talked about rave parties on the dance floor till 5 a.m. I mean, what was going on in that world in that time of your life?
5 a.m., girl, it was like till Tuesday, you know?
Okay, longer than 5 a.m.
So here's what's interesting. I was wired. I needed a cocktail when I was like four. So it was just, you know, when I first went into rooms of recovery, I almost felt guilty, Liz, because I would hear a lot of these stories of trauma and abuse. People had suffered a lot. Yeah. And I thought, what's my excuse? I had a nice upbringing. My parents did a great job. I had some normal stuff, divorce, but nothing. Look, my mom was a great mom. Now, here's what's interesting. She didn't have to do anything intentionally to me for me to interpret through a lens of, I just looked at her and inherently felt like I'm not enough. She never told me that. In fact, she told me, you are enough. You're wonderful. You can do anything you want. You know, women are powerful. It's just not what I heard.
But that's not how your brain interpreted it.
Not how my brain interpreted it. It was just my reality. So I wanted to escape the pressure of living between my two ears so badly that the minute I heard about the availability of this party lifestyle that was indulgent and hedonistic and the music, and this is in the 90s where the rave culture was just beginning to prevail, I was like, where do I sign up? And on the first episode of the Gratitudeology podcast, I tell the story about literally, I watched this 2020 episode and they were like, it was Barbara Walters and we're going to uncover the dangers of the rave scene. And they were talking about how people were taking drugs and dying. And I was like, oh, where do I get on that list? That sounds amazing. Why did I feel like that? I don't know. But for whatever reason, I was never scared. I was just intrigued. And so from the second I kind of heard about that, I was in, and it just took me down this path. When you were in public relations also in the 90s and early 2000s, that lent itself to that lifestyle. That's how you made friends and associations, and you wanted to be in with the celebrities and the cool gossip columnists at Page Six. You were doing coke in the bathroom at 5 a.m. It's just how it kind of worked.
Wow.
So I kind of went through all of that, and it almost made it a little bit harder to get clean because it was very much tied with my identity.
Let's go back to your teenage years too, because you've just talked about some of those vices and addictions, but you were also a competitive horseback rider. And I love that your horse was named Bud Light. That's such a funny story. But you did have two catastrophic injuries within a very short period of time. One of them happening when you were preparing for the Junior Olympic trials. And then that leads you down like another path, this time an addiction to painkillers. Did you realize that would be such an addiction? I mean, it was almost as if they were easier to get hooked on than the street drugs, it sounds like.
I've said this 100 times, and if anyone's listening, please listen up with both ears. Whether it's for yourself or for your kids, just know this. You know, I've struggled with both street drugs and prescription drugs. And what I would say is the prescription drugs were worse than anything that ever happened with the street drugs. And the street drugs took me down. But the prescription drugs, the first time around, it was the opiates.
Yeah.
And the second time around, I had gotten sober for a few years. And then I had convinced myself, because I was working really hard and I was running my own PR company this time, I started taking Adderall. So this is like a fast forward. That was actually in my 20s. It's so easy to have a gray area in your mind.
Yeah.
And there's no gray area, especially if you have a predisposition to become addicted, which I do. And I knew that even when I took that Adderall that first time, but I convinced myself, you know, I think I really have ADD. Like, it's hard for me to concentrate. Yeah, duh. It's hard for everyone to concentrate. Okay. Give me a break. I had no business taking that. But yeah, my doctor didn't know what he was doing when he prescribed me. He didn't know that he was setting me up for a lifetime of struggles. He was just trying to help me with a very bad injury that I had. But it's something that we know a lot more about now. So I just think that people can go in with eyes wide open.
And I would guess he probably didn't know anything about the cocaine unless you were really transparent and upfront with him. And if he had known that, maybe he would not have prescribed some of those other drugs for you. I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it was more than just cocaine. It was really all club drugs that I had issues with. And so even after I had gotten sober, there were times when I would go into like dental surgery. And I would first say to them, hey, I'm just letting you know up front, I can't be prescribed any minor mood altering substance. I'm an addict in recovery. And by the time I would go back and actually have the surgery, I would change my mind and convince them to give me. We're so good. And you know what, Liz, it's not because I'm deceptive or manipulative. It's just because my brain gets hijacked by these thoughts. And that's really why you need a deep support system if you are in recovery, because left to our own devices, my brain is not a neighborhood I should go into without adult supervision.
You were the daughter of Joan London, very public, prominent figure, co-host of Good Morning America. She was on the show for decades and often called America's sweetheart. Even though she may not have put pressure on you, you felt it. That was your own sort of psyche going through all of that. Did she have a clue that you were an addict or not?
It's such a tough question. And we just answered it the other day. We were on a television show the other day, and she was kind of wading through this question. And I have so much empathy for her because I'm a mother now of two little boys. And so I know how hard it is as a working mother. You're just trying to keep your head above water. She was working so hard to give us the life that we had, you know, and to keep up and to do everything that she had to do. Did she know? On some hands, on one hand, she knew. She was told by other mothers or by different circumstances that happened. But I was a really good talker. I would convince her everything was fine. And at the end of the day, it's really called denial. She just didn't want to believe that I was in as deep as I was. I was high functioning. I was a competitive horseback rider. I got the silver medal in the Junior Olympics in 99. I won the national finals in the US in 96. She was like, how could she be doing this and also be on the struggle bus? And it's like, because some people can do that, right? Yeah. And you can until you can't.
What was that rock bottom final moment?
You have several of them before you actually take action. I mean, I remember being a young teenager, being in my bedroom and thinking like, is this it? You know, with my heart beating really fast or just being in so much fear, but being scared to ask for help and just being like, if it is, it is. But the very end of the end was when I had been in and out of rooms of recovery for several years. I tried so hard to do it on my own. And by the way, just for anyone wondering, I do believe that people can get sober just in AA, just in 12-step recovery. You don't have to go away to treatment. You don't have to do any. 12-step recovery is a wonderful way to get sober. I was struggling at that point. I had just been in and out so much, right? And I had been inconsistent that finally I had had that relapse on Adderall, which I had shared about earlier. At that point, the way that I was using it, I would be up for several days and then kind of conk out for like 2 days. It was just as bad as anything that ever happened with street drugs. I was using it like in that way. I wasn't at parties. I was like working. So I was convincing myself I was productive, but really I was in a rabbit hole of almost psychosis. And my mom finally came and banged down my door. And I had at that point what I call the gift of desperation. And it is a gift.
Yeah.
Because I was ready to wave the white flag. And at that point, she did say, what do you think we need to do? And I said, I think I need to go to treatment. And so I did go away to treatment. And thank God I've been sober since then. But that was the additional layer I needed, just a little time and space away from New York City. And I took every recommendation at that point. I was so at my bottom. And that's why I call it a gift, because you're actually open. In the earlier times, none of my yets had come true. They always say, you know, I wasn't unemployed and unemployable yet. I hadn't lost all my friends and family yet. And so my yets had started to come true. And I was just like, I'll do anything. And when you're at that point, that's really helpful, because I literally was like, I will stay at treatment as long as I need. I will go stay in a halfway house. I did all those things. And the studies show that the longer you give yourself in some sort of structured recovery, the better chance you have. And so I did all of that.
What I think is also important here is that you realized, I can't do this on my own. I do need help. And as you said, AA may work for people and they don't have to go to treatment centers, but they do need help, whether it's AA or something. How hard was it to get clean? And what did you go through emotionally and physically to get there?
Oof, it was tough. So I was very glad that I was in treatment at that point, because there's no way that I would have stayed my ground if I hadn't been in that supportive environment. It was physically painful. It was mentally painful, but I was so ready. Like, I really wanted it so badly. Mm-hmm. I was so disappointed in myself for the years earlier because I just couldn't stick with it. And it was so tough. So I have a lot of empathy for people in early recovery. In 12-step rooms, they say the newcomer is the most important person in any meeting. And that's because, like, we all just get it. Like, you get what it feels like to be there. It's not fun, but it's so worth it. And so there's a common phrase in recovery circles, like don't quit before the miracle happens, right? Like you have to get through the white knuckling part, the crappy part. But when the miracle happens and you cross that hump, beautiful things occur. And life has just been, again, as I say in the program, it's like you're rocketed to a fourth dimension of living you didn't even know was possible. And that's like the rest of your life afterwards. And you're like, oh my God, this was here the whole time? I didn't know.
Well, you've gone through so much healing and transforming, dedicating your life to wellness and getting it back on track. And you meet George, a blind date. And you have said that the two of you just knew. What did you know?
I walked in that restaurant on our first date and I looked in his eyes and I was like, this is it. And he said he knew it was the exact same thing. What's interesting also, Liz, is that on our first date, we kind of just like put everything out on the table.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm a sober addict in recovery. He was like, I have three adult grown kids. I was like, we're like, okay.
Okay.
He's 20 years older than me, which honestly, we've never even noticed, truly. At this point, we're 43 and 63 years old, but that was 12 years ago when we first met. He's a very youthful energy. I'm kind of an old soul. So we never really noticed. The age difference is completely inconsequential. But other than just, you know, having a fun physical attraction, he's a good person in his heart. And here's what's interesting. I think if I had met him any bit before when I actually did, I wouldn't have been ready. Dr. Phil says relationships aren't 50-50. They're 100-100.
Yes.
And I had to wait until I was 100. And it just turns out that he had done work on himself and he was 100. When I was set up on that blind date, my friend who set us up said, Jamie, why don't you have a boyfriend? I said, because I'm happy. And that was the truth. I didn't need one.
Yeah.
And that's when he fell into my lap. I've seen him have one drink, which was on our second date. He had a drink, which is fine. And then after that, I was about to celebrate 4 years sober at that time. And he said, hey, could I come to that meeting with you and help you celebrate? It sounds like this like recovery thing is important to you. I would just like to learn more about it. I don't know much about that. And he came to the meeting and he heard the speaker at that meeting share. And he said, oh, shoot, I think I belong here. And he stayed. And now he just celebrated 12 years sober. So I think that has a great bearing on the quality of our relationship. Yeah. In 12 years, we've just been happy together for 12 years. And I think it's because so much of what I learned in the rooms of recovery, which is what I teach, the whole gratitudeology system came from a life lived in sobriety, integrity, all of that good stuff. You know, we let each other be imperfect. We don't have to be right. We don't have to nitpick. We just allow each other to kind of coexist on this journey and we support each other. And that's very much a recovery sensibility.
Well, I love the fact that he proposed to you on a treadmill following a Barry's boot camp class. I mean, I think there's a whole nother story there that we'll have to dig into another day. And then you guys start this at NYC Fit Fam Instagram account, still going strong. You guys are even named one of the 7 fittest couples on Instagram. I mean, you guys really are out there. So now let's fast forward a little bit. You mentioned having 2 boys and you have all this wonderful success and yet another addiction battle just around the corner following the birth of your first child. You have admitted and talked publicly about how hard it was to love him when he was first born. And a lot of women I've heard say when they have that first child in those early days, and you eventually self-medicate, not with drugs, but this time with food. How does a fitness influencer end up with an eating disorder?
Well, first of all, addiction is like whack-a-mole. You get one of them taken care of and something else pops up. So what had happened for me was I had been sober many years, but at that point I was a little bit what you call a dry drunk. I wasn't as involved in meetings. And, you know, they often say it's a God-sized hole that you're filling with drugs and alcohol. So when you stop medicating, and the medication is God, spirituality, connectedness, prayer, meditation, when you stop working a program, your isms tend to come back, whatever it is, the alcoholism, just the different mental neuroses. I had eating disorders in the past. I had had both anorexia and bulimia as a teenager. Food addiction for me is the easiest go-to. And I think it's very, very difficult because with drugs, you can just stop the drugs. With alcohol, you can just not drink, but you can't stop eating. So you're always going to trigger that ism. If that's a part of your ethos, like it's coming back. In 12-step circles around food addiction, it's very difficult. They do have you abstain from like flour and sugar, but it's like, you don't know when you're going to get triggered in a grocery store aisle, which is why it's very important to be honest. I always say we're only as sick as our secrets, and I kept this one a secret. So I will say this. I had a lot of shame and guilt when I first had my child because we're told it's supposed to be the happiest time of your life and rainbows and butterflies. I did love my child, but I didn't feel that. I didn't feel rainbows and butterflies. I felt what I now know is postpartum depression, but I didn't want to admit that that was what it was. I had all sorts of crazy thoughts going on. And people were telling me, eat whatever you want. You're breastfeeding. And so I was eating a lot of sugar and carbs. And it was triggering and kicking up a lot of this stuff in me where all of a sudden I felt bad about my body. And so then the thought occurred to me, well, you should make yourself throw up because you're a fitness influencer. You can't gain weight. And I just started convincing myself of all of that craziness. But very quickly, it started feeling as obsessive, the thinking, as when I had done drugs. So very quickly, it began to feel like I was no longer sober because I was binging and purging. Until I got honest about that, I was in the exact same place I had been in my early 20s. There was no way I was going to be able to stop doing this without help. Mm-hmm. And so the help for me in that moment was raising my hand and telling my husband and just saying, I just need help. I'm going to figure out exactly what the help is. And for us, it was a really structured program where we didn't have certain trigger foods in the house. I had accountability measures with him where he helped me kind of manage some of my thoughts and feelings. I didn't go into a grocery store for the first year kind of unaccompanied because I could be feeling really, really good. And then the next thing you know, I'm in the frozen food aisle and seeing ice cream, which was a trigger food for me, and thinking, you know, it'd be a really great escape. And then before you know it, right, you're doing something that you don't want to do. So you got to be really vigilant. These things are not to be toyed with. And so I really treated it as seriously as I treated my addiction.
You talk about that whole journey in your TEDx talk. And also you mentioned, and you touched on it a moment ago, about how hard it is to ask for help. And that's often one of the bravest things any of us can do. Why do you think it's so hard for anyone to ask for help of any kind, for that matter?
I've coached women now for a long time, and the first 2 years of my coaching were specifically around weight loss and wellness, although now I've really expanded to personal and professional development of all sorts. But when I was hyper-focused on the weight loss and wellness space, what I would hear, Liz, more often than anything else is, I don't know, it seems silly. Like, it seems silly to these women. Now, for some reason, if it was cocaine, we would feel like that was an okay thing to talk about. And even like, you know, legally with jobs, you legally have to be able to go to your boss and say, hey, I'm really struggling with alcohol. I have to go to rehab for 30 days and you have to hold my job, by the way, according to the Family Medical Leave Act, right? So that's actually your legal obligation. Like, we can have that conversation now around drugs and alcohol because we understand it's a diagnosable medical illness. We just are not there yet with food. Yeah. And so I feel like with women in particular, they feel like it's silly. They feel like they don't deserve the help and they're embarrassed. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes I will ask them, well, how long have you been dealing with this? Like this monkey on your back? I don't know. It started when I was like 13 or 15. And I'm like, all right, how old are you now, Susan? Well, I'm, you know, 57. Okay. How long do you have to fight this battle on your own before you think maybe I deserve help?
Jamie, as you look back over your life, what limiting beliefs have you had to conquer, and how did you do it?
Every single day, I have limiting beliefs. According to the data, 70% of people experience imposter syndrome, which, by the way, I think is very low. I think almost everybody, except for maybe like egomaniacal narcissists, experience imposter syndrome. I like to say this. I think your imposter syndrome comes up in one of three forms, and this is something I coach on. The first one I like to call mini-me, and mini-me is often a previous version of yourself. And so for me, I'll be, you know, ready to sign like a big, like a seven-figure business deal. And I'm like doing the damn thing and reaching my dreams. And 19-year-old me will crop up and say, are you nuts? We can't do that. We're a drug addict. We're incapable. We can hardly get out the door. And I have to give her a hug and say, it's okay. That's not us anymore. I've got this now. But thanks for stopping by. Thanks for trying to protect us. But we actually can. The second one I like to call Lazy Susan. Lazy Susan is just a version of yourself that's like, sounds like it's going to be really hard. We should just crap out. That sounds hard. Let's not try. I don't want to. Once we get into this, we're going to like be obligated to see it through to the end. And it sounds really scary and hard. So with her, I got to look her in the eye and be like, girl, even if we fail, half the battle is just showing up. So we're going to do this. And whether we either succeed or learn a great lesson in the process, we're showing up. Mm. The last one I like to call the judger. Actually, this is a tricky one. The judger actually believes that you can do it, that you can do the thing, but is scared you're going to be judged on the other side. So this is a lot of people I find like don't want to post on social media or talk about their success because like, what if my Aunt Sally thinks I'm bragging? Who cares about your Aunt Sally? Does Aunt Sally pay your mortgage? Not last time I checked, but we care so much what other people think. So these are all limiting beliefs. They just take these different forms.
You have so many irons in the fire today. You're a contributor sharing healthy living advice on Good Morning America, The Today Show, The View. You have Zuda Activewear on QVC, and you've got your podcasts. And I know it's been very important to you all throughout your life that you worked really hard not to let people know that you were Joan London's daughter. That was really important to you. But today, you and your mom are doing projects together. How does that feel?
It feels amazing. It's not that I didn't want people to know. It just wasn't my leading message.
Yes.
I think it's very important as the daughter of somebody that you're not viewed as receiving things that you don't deserve. And I worked really hard to earn the things that I have. I respect and look up to my mother so much. We are literally best friends. I mean, she's my best friend in the world. My sisters and I are all very close. We have a really close, tight-knit family. So it's so cool. And my mom and I literally do a lot of brand campaigns together, which is really fun. And my mom's a keynote speaker. And now I am a keynote speaker. So I've been so blessed. I literally have the best role model and media trainer on the planet. When I first started on QVC, I would call her before every presentation. And I would say, okay, mom, I'm selling this sweatshirt. It's a sweatshirt. I don't know what else to say about it. And she would say, okay, let's talk about the fabric. Let's practice what you're going to say about the hems. Because she knows. She knows what it is to just bring something to life on television in a way that breaks the fourth wall. So she's really guided me through every part of my life. And I just love and respect her so much.
In one sentence, what's the best advice she ever gave you?
My mom just looks at life through rose-colored glasses. What's really interesting, Liz, is that this is what having an attitude of gratitude means. But I think what I'm always trying to combat is I don't want people to mistake having an attitude of gratitude with toxic positivity. When I was younger and my mom looked at the world through rose-colored glasses and I just wasn't in that place, I thought I was dark and twisty and emotional and wrote poetry and, like, you know, listened to like moody music. And I just didn't get how she did what she did. Now I understand she put those glasses on, even on days when they felt heavy. Mm-hmm. She insisted on seeing the world through rose-colored lenses because every day you have a choice.
That's right.
You can look at it through the dark lenses or you can look at it through the rose-colored lenses. And so she didn't always just wake up and say everything's great when it wasn't. She said, I'm going to choose to see the bright side and I'm going to choose to count my blessings first before I look at the problems. And now I get it. But it took me years of overcoming things to understand that that was the most important lesson she ever gave me.
If you'd like to learn more about Jamie's great work, just go to her website, meetjamiehess.com. We'll have that link in our show notes along with all of her social handles, and you can find out about her podcast. Jamie, you have shown us that changing our attitude to life and to work really can lead to living our best life. Thank you so much for sharing your story with all of us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to all of you listening around the world, may all of you be filled with gratitude, knowing that it can change your life. Until next time, be well.
This podcast is brought to you in part by Fast Twitch Media, helping people tell their stories, giving them worldwide reach. The future is in the cloud, and Fast Twitch Media can take you there. Be your best digital self. Check out fasttwitchmedia.space.